irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Matt, it's been about a month since we've been on the show together, but we're back together, and although I'm not in studio, I'm excited to be back on the air.
And it's great to hear you, Alan, and I'm really excited to be back together on Answers for the Family. I hope you had a wonderful holiday, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain.
While bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for your family.
Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
Alan, you know, one of the best parts of our show is really having guests that have incredible stories, and we love hearing them, and we also love sharing them.
You know, Matt, I take pride in the fact that we do this show to help people learn and for us to personally grow and to provide a platform for good humans who care about the world, give back, and have wonderful messages.
And personally, I love hearing the stories that are inspiring, positive, and messages that really give hope. And today's guests check all the boxes. And personally, he checks another box with me because he's a former and fellow Arizona Wildcat.
Well, we're truly honored to have with us Dr. Alan Hamilton, who, along with being an Arizona Wildcat, is a graduate from Harvard Medical School, served as a medical officer in Operation Desert Storm, and is a decorated U.S. Army veteran.
But did I mention he's an Arizona Wildcat? Anyways,
I don't know. Maybe we should mention that again.
Dr. Hamilton has been honored by his peers and was named as one of America's best doctors for the last 18 consecutive years. He's also written more than a dozen chapters in medical textbooks and nearly 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles.
Now, you may have seen him on the NBC Today Show, ABC Evening News, or one of many other featured news and media outlets. Now, his newest book, Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses, dives into the world of what we as humans can learn from horses.
I was excited to hear we were having Dr. Hamilton on the show. And Alan, I know through West Shield, you've worked with a lot of programs that integrate equine therapy. And personally, I've got a lot of experiences and knowledge of the benefits of equine therapy. But this book really expands much further.
Yes, because Dr. Hamilton's book looks at parenting, relationships, and touches on his experiences, including using horses to teach graduate medical students, which is really fascinating stuff. So without any further ado, Dr. Hamilton, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you, Alan. Thank you, Matt, for having me. I really appreciate it.
We're excited to have you. And one of the things I found interesting was really your personal story, just in itself, is somewhat it's very inspiring. Did I read somewhere that you actually started as a janitor?
Yeah, I started my working life as a janitor. I'm one of the worst people to bring to career day at high school because I just stand up there and say, look, I just careened around like a pinball in a pinball machine. But I started off as a janitor, and I got a part-time job cleaning up a veterinary hospital. And it's kind of dirty work, but I was mopping the floor, and I could see through the window in the operating room. I could see them operating, and I kind of got interested, and I guess I must have spent a lot of time mopping outside the OR, because one of the veterinary surgeons took pity on me and said, look, if you get your chores done, you can come in here and help and hold retractors. And one thing led to another, and I really wanted to be a surgeon. I wanted to be ended up being a brain surgeon, but It started off with mopping floors. And to this day, my residents are very, very careful when they're with me about not walking across a freshly mopped floor. I think I walk along the corner near the wall because I said, you don't know what it's like to mop floors. But I do.
Well, you know, I think to follow up on that, you know, I think that you would actually be great to bring to Career Day, because I think for all of the kids out there to be able to listen and say, wow, I can, you know, I can start anywhere and I can achieve my dreams by focusing, and I may find something. I may start with that job that we all get that kind of helps get us through school, or, you know, makes us a little extra spending money, that I might be able to turn that into something where I can do a lot of good and help a lot of people.
Well, and I also think along the way, you know, we talked about family and we, you know, I'm sure we'll hit on passion and things like that. But when, you know, young people are exposed to people who are passionate about what they do, they inspire more those young people. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very interested in is that healthcare is changing a lot. And we have a lab where we do a lot of simulation and virtual reality games. And, you know, we get these kids in high school who think, you know, there's no way I could ever think about a career in healthcare. And I go, well, are you good at computer games? And they go, yeah. And I said, well, we're looking for people who are good at computer games, because everything now is related to this eye-hand coordination that goes with a computer screen. And so we find kids who really don't think they have any talent for science or anything else. And we get them on these games that are simulated surgery, and they're just outstanding. I had one kid who was 18 years old whose performance parameters were the equivalent of faculty. And I go, did you ever think about becoming a surgeon? And he goes, no, why? And I said, well, you have the equivalent of about 100-mile-an-hour fastball pitch. Somebody ought to put it to good use, because you got some real talent with eye-hand coordination. So, I think sometimes you're right in the sense that a lot of our lives are not planned, and they're not necessarily linear, but they are journeys. And along the way, if we're lucky, we meet people who inspire us and help us and change our lives. And that surgeon in there did. You know, he changed the course of my life.
And listening to the story, the psychologist in me asked the question, is it that you found, is it having someone that's inspiring or someone really excited, like the man that you met in the OR room of the veterinarian clinic, or is it finding something that you're passionate about, or is it a combination of both, do you feel?
I think it goes, I think sometimes, you know, I think we're born with passions. You know, I think one of the telling things is, I started off life thinking I wanted to be a painter, which is one of the reasons I ended up as a janitor. but you know, I think one of the interesting statistics that I that always makes me a little fearful, if you will, is that if you go into a first grade classroom and you ask these kids, you know, who's an artist in here, 80% of the hands will go up in the class. If you go into a sixth grade classroom and ask the same question, less than 10% will go up. And so somehow we're killing off the artists in us. And I think, you know, part of it is finding out where that artist comes alive again. And I think there are great teachers who do that. I think there are seminal experiences that do that. I think sometimes a parent or a grandparent or a sibling provides that outlet. I became a horseman and a horse trainer because my grandfather helped raise me, and he was a very accomplished equestrian. And that was the big thing that he and I shared together, that was our joint passion that sort of bridged two generations, and, you know, it bound us together, you know, during life and after he passed. You know, And I raised Lipizzan horses because he was an equestrian rider who rode in the Spanish riding school where they have Lipizzan stallions. So it's, you know, under the right circumstances, we're a lucky congregation of beautiful sources of light and warmth and affection that inspire us and move us along on a track. And, you know, I think part of it's what's from within. and part of it's what's presented from without. And I think the same thing is true of a horse. You know, I think you bring a horse into the round pen and you start to train that horse, and part of it is the breeding and the, you know, the composition of the horse and how it's put together. And you know, part of it is also that spark of partnership with that horse where you're really in sync and you feel, you know, bound to each other and trusting of each other and able to tackle things together. And I'm often inspired by horses to go back to my life and reevaluate some of my values, because I think they're wonderful teachers. You kind of see the world differently when you're working with them.
You know, Dr. Hamilton, how did you go from, I mean, as a Harvard-trained brain surgeon, how did you know to put together the fact that horses would be such an intricate part in what you can do to help humans?
Well, I think, you know, there was these twin paths. I'd always been, I've been involved with training horses for nearly 30 years, and it's my big kind of avocation. I always say, you know, brain surgery is the left side of my brain, and, you know, it's all stainless steel and precision and all of this, and horses is all intuitive and emotional. That's the right brain. And they balance each other out. But in point of fact, that where they came together was one afternoon I had an emergency procedure and I had patients in clinic. So I was downstairs in the OR with my residents and we were running about an hour and a half late. And I know doctors are always notorious for running late in clinic, but this was really late. So I'd had the nurses put the patients in the exam room so they were ready for me when I got to the clinic. And we kind of, you know, I had this cloud of residents behind me, and we kind of burst into one of the rooms, and there was a patient in there. It wasn't undressed or anything, but we came in so fast that she went, oh, you know, kind of cried out. And I thought to myself, you know, if I had done that to a horse, they'd have handed me my head. You know, they would have knocked my block right off. And I thought, God, you know, I wouldn't come up on a horse like that, but I did come up on a patient. So we started looking at some things. And actually, I started videotaping myself because I figured people would get bent out of shape if I videotaped them to start. And what mm-hmm. I found appalled me. You know, like I'd see on a videotape, this was still when we had films that you put on a light box. And I saw that I would put the films on the light box and I'd be in front and look at the films, but I'd be talking to the patient behind me, who was behind my shoulder. So yes, I was communicating with them, but my body was sending the message that your films are more important than you are. I'm talking to your films. And I thought, you know, when I looked at that, I said, geez, if I was doing that with a horse, I'd stand next to the horse so the horse understood. So I said, well, why don't I do that with patients? And then we'd go on rounds, and the team would be presenting data back and forth, and the patient would be in the background. So we said, let's change that. We'll put the person who's presenting next to the patient. We'll drop the bed rail so that when they're presenting the data, they're sending the physical message. The patient and I are presenting our data to the rest of the team, not the rest of the team is talking amongst themselves, and the patient isn't even, you know, is almost like not present there. So we started that, and, you know, we began to realize that there were a lot of nonverbal things that you do naturally with horses that would translate into better bedside manner and better communication. And since 80% of what we communicate is nonverbally, it's a big part of how we establish our relationship with our patients, particularly with patients, because, you know, for a patient, you're going from a dead start where you've just met each other to a very intimate distance, which normally you wouldn't let anybody into that space except somebody you were very, very close and loved. So you have to bridge that gap, and you have to create a sense of trust, and you do that with your body, you know, and you do that with your nonverbal communication and how you listen and, you know, let the patient tell their story. The average patient is interrupted within 29 and a half seconds from the time they start talking.
Wow.
Learn from horses, hey, sit back, let it happen, let them tell their story. They'll tell you what you need to hear. Just be patient and let them tell it. So bit by bit, you know, we put a program together where we work with medical students. And, you know, I'm always shocked at how much The students love the course, and I had a student last year who graduated, and at the end of graduation, had brought their parents up to me and said, "This is the guy who taught me with horses," and that was in the first year of medical school. And I was so touched that, you know, at the end of medical school, that they still wanted to introduce their parents to me. But, you know, I was very, very touched by that.
And it's almost, listening to you and the way you teach, are the future doctors and the people you're teaching, are they open to kind of pulling up that mirror and looking at themselves and being able to kind of evaluate their nonverbal communication and verbal communication?
Well, you know, looking at the field of medicine, I'm impressed that I have never in 30 years as a, you know, an academic surgeon, I've never met a medical student who wasn't earnestly interested in helping human beings. And so medical students are very, very open to this. What is troubling is that over the course of their training as residents, they become very sarcastic. They become cynical. And one time I went up to one of our chief residents when they were finishing up and they were doing their goodbye talk, and it was very cynical and very, you know, very pointed kind of humor and that sort of thing. And I said to this guy, you know, "Andrew, where did all this come from?" And he turned around and said to me, "You know, Dr. Hamilton, you need to look, all of you as a faculty, because you're the window through which we learn about medicine and about surgery. And it's a very dark vision that you let us see." And so, you know, I think we, just like we kill off the artists, I think we kill off sometimes the caring and the compassion. So, you know, I take a lot more care to make sure that stays alive. I think the trick is to keep it alive, not to kill it. It's there to start with. It's something that we gradually over time eliminate. There was a very interesting study that was done with residents where they, beginning of their residency, you know how they ask patients on a scale of 1 to 10, is this, the, you know, what, how much pain are you in? Mm-hmm. So they would ask the patients, you know, scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? And then they'd ask the residents on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain do you think they're in? And at the very beginning, there was very good correspondence between the patient's report of their pain and the resident's report of their pain. After 6 months to a year, there was a huge discrepancy where the residents were downgrading the pain much lower than the patients because they said to themselves, "I know how much pain they're having. They're exaggerating." And so it shows that you sort of become inured, you know, to seeing the suffering and the pain and that you sort of are trying to just get through the day without letting yourself be open to that. And that's part of being a doctor, is staying open to that and staying compassionate. And, you know, I always say, you know, the heart of medicine is trying to love a perfect stranger perfectly. And that's how it works. You know, you're trying to love them like you would somebody in your own family and treat them with the same kind of respect and care and kindness and commitment. So you have to try and keep it alive.
Now, to follow up on that, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's a culture, sort of a negative culture, that has been created. Is there anything that you can put your finger on to identify as to maybe what started us down that path so that there's a way to be able to go back and maybe reverse it?
Well, I think in part it's trying to learn a new models. I think, you know, medicine is becoming so much, you know, see so many patients a day, do so many surgeries a day, do this kind of amount of financial productivity every day. And, you know, what happens is that you know, there's a sense of you it's quantity, not quality, and we need to get back to quality. And I think part of it is just forcing ourselves, reminding ourselves that, you know, one day that's going to be us in that bed. And, you know, I think that it's very important to, you know, go back to personal and family experiences and remind yourself, this was what it was like, this is what it felt like, and that person's feeling the same thing. So we're spending a lot more time on humanism than we used to. You know, we're spending a lot more time doing longitudinal things with medical students where they meet a family and they stick with that family for 4 years so they understand the impact of healthcare. It's those kinds of programs that are sort of opening medicine up to a little bit more of this feeling and compassion and commitment than in the past.
And it's inspiring hearing that because I feel like in my world of psychology and the psychiatric world, to me it feels like, you know, for instance, most psychiatrists don't spend time with patients anymore. They've got a revolving door and they meet with them for 5 minutes and they write a script. And when I was in graduate school, one of the cool things that I did was similar to what you're saying, is we stayed with the patient for a few years, and the work we did was so much more fulfilling, and you spent the time, so it wasn't a numbers game, it was a, you know, commitment to a person game. And to me, I'm just have a huge smile listening to you, seeing that we're going against the current of do as many things as you can and knock it all out, but it's more focused on the product versus, you know, the productivity or whatever.
You know, I think that you hit on something else there, Matt, that what's happening is more and more doctors are burning out and more are dissatisfied with their careers. And the reason is they're getting farther and farther removed from that commitment, which is really what got them started in the first place. So I think, you know, one of the things that is really going to help medicine is to rediscover its soul. And that is, we get a lot of satisfaction out of taking care of patients and taking good care of patients. And when you take bad care of patients, it makes you sick. It makes you angry. And so I think that, you know, you're absolutely right that we have to go back to the idea of this isn't a kind of a wham-bam kind of encounter. You know, I remember I was looking at my clinic schedule, and I specialized in the area of brain tumors, you know, and brain cancer. And the scheduler was telling me that I had 20 minutes for new patients. And I said, you got to be kidding. I mean, these people are coming to the door. They're scared as heck. And I'm going to sit down and tell them they have a brain tumor and they have to have surgery. And all of that and the exam and the history is supposed to only take 20 minutes. And I said, you know, I just said, screw it. I'm going to take an hour, and that's what's going to be on my schedule because that's what's demanded. That's just it.
Well, unfortunately, it sounds like you're the exception, not the rule, at least as we go more into this, you know, the healthcare industry as a whole. I know that, you know, I feel very blessed of the fact that I had a doctor like yourself, and I had one that took a lot of time, and he ended up kind of like you're saying, he ended up retiring, and somebody else came in and took over his practice, and you know, now they can see, you know, three times as many people because because they can do the whatever, you know, spend 2 minutes with you rather than do what he did. So you know, let's hope that there are more coming up the ranks, you know, like yourself and like my doctor that retired.
Do you have time for a Wildcat story?
I always have time for a Wildcat story.
Okay, so there's a famous cardiologist named Roman DeSantis, okay, and he is graduated from the University of Arizona, and he was the head of cardiology when I was at Harvard, and I was a medical student, and I was on the cardiology rotation, and I was seeing one of his patients who was an elderly lady from the North End of Boston, and I went to see her, and I examined her, and I was writing my note and everything, and catching up with everything that was going on with her, and she said to me, you know, I'd like you not to tell Dr. DeSantis when he comes through everything that we talked about. And I said, you know, I thought maybe there's some confidentiality. And she says, no, it has nothing to do with that. It's just that, you know, I think I'm his only patient. And, you know, he comes down and I just want him to have something to talk about and do when he gets here. Now, Dr. DeSantis was the busiest cardiologist I ever met, and he probably had 70 or 80 patients every single day in the hospital. But the thing that was so amazing was that lady, he would come in, he would sit on the end of the bed, he would talk with her, and he gave her the impression that she was the only patient he had in the hospital. And I thought, what a gift. What a wonderful thing to have your patient concerned that you're the only patient they have, and you only have them to listen to. So I was so impressed by that.
That's amazing, and the actual quality of it, and the way to go about performing like he does, are specifics that you even go into in the book when you talk about how to be heard, and discussing how you whispering plays a part. And I know we've veered off, but this book is so dense and there's so much great stuff out in there. Could you touch a little bit on that portion of it, just so people can start getting their palate wet, I guess?
Sure. Going back to, really the issues of answers for families, one of the things that that I learned from horses was to be a better parent, I had to be able to listen more carefully. And horses are all about reading, the horse reading your language and you reading and listening to the horse's language. And the horse insists on patience, because if you rush things with the horse says, you're not committed to me. You're not showing integrity to this relationship. And so one of the things I learned was, when I would go and listen to my kids, I usually would let them start talking, but I was looking for when they took a breath for me to be able to tell them what I thought. And then I gradually learned from horses, just listen. Don't have an agenda. It's one of the most important things horses teach you, is don't have an agenda, because agendas hurt relationships. Because you're more committed to what your objective is than to the partnership. So horses teach you to slow down, listen carefully, listen actively, listen and in depth, and really just be there for for the other person, and truly trying to gauge what they're trying to tell you, and not so much what you want to get across. And so I wish I had learned that lesson earlier. As a parent, but better late than never. But one of the things horses teach you is to get quiet inside and truly actively listen, and become a committed listener.
No, I think that's a great point, and I know that Matt talks a lot about boundaries, and you discussed this subject in the book as well. So share with us a little bit, how do horses apply to the concept of boundaries?
Well, boundaries are, as you know, in relationships, boundaries are very, very important. And the thing about horses is they define space around them, and you define space around yourself as the trainer. And, you're dealing with a 1,000-pound animal. It's one of the reasons it works so well to have students learning bedside manner with a nonverbal patient that weighs 1,000 pounds. They learn a lot of respect. But, one of the things that happens with horses, you have to say to this 1,000-pound creature, I have a boundary, and I can't have you rushing into my personal space at a full gallop. I need for you to respect my boundaries and my shell. And when I invite you in, that's fine. But if I don't invite you in, I'm going to ask you to stay away. And so one of the keys to training a horse and creating that partnership is to let that horse know you'll give them a clear signal when you want them to come in. So, for example, if I want them to come in and rest next to me and give me a chance to reward them for something they've done, I'm going to say, hey, this is the chance. Come into my space. This is where I need you. And so it's one of these things that you sort of figure out with training horses, and then you go back and apply it to your life, which is messy boundaries create messy relationships. When you start to have a friend who asks you for a loan, or you start to have somebody ask you for a favor that you're not really comfortable granting, and then you say, I'll go along with that or whatever. You create a mess. And the thing is, with a horse, you're going to know it. You're going to have a 1,000-pound creature that's, is going to try and jump in your back pocket. You don't want that. You want a horse that respects those boundaries. And so very early on, you learn to use your body language and your energy to tell the horse, no, this is where I feel comfortable. And when I know that horse better, and I trust that horse more profoundly, my personal space gets smaller because I feel much more comfortable with them. But if I'm starting off with a like a wild Mustang, believe me, I've got a huge barrier because that horse is a wild animal, and you know he's got a natural terrible fear of humans at that point. And I've got to say, hey, let's keep this boundary where we're both safe, and once we're comfortable, you and I will agree to slowly diminish it until we have a comfort level that's very close. But boundaries are essential to relationships, whether it be training horses or your coworkers, your family members. You know, and I think with horses, it's sort of the very first thing you have to establish.
Well, I'm not a 1,000-pound stallion, but I do have to set a boundary on both you guys. It's our commercial break. And we were going to take a quick commercial break. Right, we'll be back with Dr. Hamilton. The book is Lead With Your Heart. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and our guest today is Dr. Alan Hamilton. He is the author of The Scalpel and the Soul. He's also the author of Zen Mind, Zen Horse, and the book that we're talking about today, which is Lead With Your Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. So, Dr. Hamilton, one of the areas of relationships that I think all of us are often asked about is that of affection. The book talks about practicing affection. Share a little bit with our audience what you mean by this.
A lot of times when people are training horses, they get into the grind of the training and the repetition and the drills and the going from step to step, and they lose sight of the fact that what's really fundamentally important is the partnership that you're developing with that horse for life. And you know, a lot of times when I'm teaching people about training horses, I say, well, you know, go ahead and pet him, tell him thank you for doing what he just did. And you know, I have this mantra, which is, you know, pause, pet, breathe. And you know, I always go, you know, take a moment, pause, pet, breathe. And the reason I want them to stop, I want them to pet the horse because I want that horse to get the reward, the affection, and the bonding, and the breathing because I want them to let their body relax so the horse gets that sense of release. And one of the things, you know, I have a saying over my barn, which is from an old French cavalry officer, which says, you know, ask for a lot, settle for less, and reward frequently. And you know, one of the things that horses want is they want that partnership and that sense of working together, and affection is a vital component of telling them, hey, thank you for doing that, and you did that right. That was great what you did, and you showed, you know, or the horse that tackles a jump, and you go, look, you showed heart, you showed courage, and you know, you want to practice it. Not only, you know, I mean, the point is I start off with horses, but then I go, you know, practice it in your life. If somebody at work is doing a good job, so often we forget to pause and say, hey, thank you for doing that for me, or that was well done, or you stepped in and took care of that problem for me. And I think, you know, we have to cultivate the art of affection, the practice of affection.
You know, as I'm sitting here listening, I'm thinking, obviously, I'm learning a lot, and I really appreciate you spending time with us today, Dr. Hamilton. And as I'm sitting here, a lot of it, as I'm, you know, as I'm, I read the book and as I'm listening to you, a lot of it is really this idea of self-reflection. And to kind of further that point, it's almost like taking a step back, and I'm so quick personally to jump in and offer advice, or so quick to jump in. But this idea of listening, stepping back, and also taking the time out to show the affection, are these kind of the main testaments of the book, or is there some other really big kind of moments that you really want us to address and to understand?
Well, I want to go back to what you said, and that is that the self-reflection. When you're training horses, when you run into problems, when you run into frustrations and obstacles, you, as a horse trainer, you always discover that you're the problem. You're facing yourself, and you have to come to grips with what is it about you that's holding the horse back. And I think, I think that's a lesson that you sort of have to learn in life, which is we create most of the obstacles in our own path. We create most of the stumbling blocks. We create the frustration, and we tend to project it outward, and the horse is saying, no, you have to look inward for the answers. You have to take a step back and slow down. And, you know, one of the keys to understanding a horse is to let that horse, affect you with its energy, and let the horse absorb your emotional energy. And that takes time. So I think one of the big lessons of this is to go back, really back to yourself, and become mindful and aware that you are having a profound effect on the environment, that you are creating a lot of the issues. And that's what horses really are teaching you, to be mindful of the energy you project out into the world.
Now, if you could touch a little bit on that, I know that having toured some of the programs that deal with working with at-risk youth with horses, share with us a little bit about the concept of why this works. In other words, in regards to them being a prey animal rather than a predator animal, and how they sense those things in humans, with they're literally sensing in us what we are.
Well, I think the big thing is that we're predators. We go after what we want. We are, we want to acquire things. We want to, we have goals. And horses are prey animals. They're after peace and tranquility. Their goal in life is to be in a pasture with two or three buddies, and as far as the eye can see, there's no threat in sight. That's what they're after: quiet, tranquility, and peace. And so to get close to an animal like that, it's the people say, if you want to be different, you have to see different. And, horses teach you to see differently, because you see the world through the eyes of a prey animal, and you go, oh, there's a different way. It isn't necessarily might is right. So one of the things that when you're working with at-risk youth, is that very often and I've worked with lots of kids out of the juvenile justice system, and for a lot of these kids, they've never had a relationship they could trust. They've been in gangs, they've been, and they've been victims of the justice system, and suddenly I can put them with an animal and I can say, this horse will never deceive you. As long as you live, this horse is not going to pretend to be your friend so that it can get you close to hurt you. This horse is going to give you exactly what you see and exactly what you put into the relationship. And for many of these kids, it's the first time they've ever had a relationship like that. And so it opens up a world to them. And it also teaches them to control their emotions, because that horse is going to be frightened. That horse is going to suddenly say, why is there all this anger and frustration in coming out in your energy? And you don't want those emotions getting in the way. And the horse teaches you to separate your energy and your emotions.
I want to take a second where we have listener questions coming through, and a couple have come through that I wanted to mention. One is just a comment to you, Dr. Hamilton, and I'd like to read it, and it's from Judith in Portland. And Judith wrote in, I have loved horses all of my life, and when I was a child, my uncle made certain that I was included with his daughters in taking us for horseback riding lessons. There is nothing like the experience, the confidence, and the connection it implants in one's being. I am very excited to read and share your book, which I ordered last week when I read you'd be on the radio show. So that's from Judith in Portland. And
well, thank you, Judith.
And I would – the other one is a quick question, if you don't mind me getting to, because I know time-wise we're running out of time, and I want to make sure everyone who wrote in, we addressed your questions. And Alan and I also want to thank everyone for writing in and calling in. We appreciate it. And so this question goes, therapeutic writing is one of the benefits of our kids' program in Temecula. We do have a suggested reading list that includes natural horsemanship, et cetera. It would be great to have an inspirational book to include. Can you tell us the age range of the readers? Youth 6 to 18 are our targeted group. Would they find this of interest, and would this age range be appropriate for your book?
Yes, I think it. You know, I think we underestimate how in tune kids are, particularly with horses. And I think, yes, it's 100 essays. Some of them, you know, maybe a little bit less relevant, for example, for a kid at 8 or 10 to talk about parenting. But I think in general it relates to relationships, and kids get that very quickly. And I think the other thing is you have the example in front of them of therapeutic writing, so they are getting that information from, you know, from the horse directly, from, you know. And I think it would be very appropriate. They'll tune into it.
All right. And the other question that came up, and I'll just kind of freehand it really quickly. They're asking about in your book about motivating people, and you had wrote us, you know, a part on motivating people. Will you share a little bit about that for us?
Well, I think you have to look in part that there's two issues. One is you have to understand what's in it for the horse. Okay, so in a lot of ways, the motivation is where's the horse coming from in this partnership, and the second thing is in trying to invite that horse to succeed. You're always looking for how to make the right thing easy for the horse to do, and good trainers make it look easy because they're finding the fastest way for the horse to be successful. So what I liken it to is I'm looking for how to ski downhill. When the horse is doing the right thing, I want it to feel like it's skiing downhill. When it tries to do the wrong thing, I want it to feel like it's skiing uphill. But the horse is intrinsically motivated to say, where's the downhill? Where is it flowing easily? And that's the key to motivating a horse. And I think the other thing is to be, you know, when you're trying to teach a horse, go slowly and remember that it takes a while for the horse to sort out what it's learning, just as it does for a kid. You want to give them the benefit of acquiring the learning over time and practicing it rather than just demanding that they be able to perform.
Now, again, for everybody out there, you know, we did drop out for a moment, but if you want to get in touch with Dr. Hamilton, again, you can go to his website. It is allenhamilton.com/ to lead with your heart, and that's Alan, A-L-L-A-N, Hamilton.com, to lead with your heart. And for those of you that are driving, again, don't worry about it. You can go to the Answers for the Family site, and we will have all of the information out there. Dr. Hamilton, thank you so much for coming on the show. I guess one question is, what's next for you? Because we would love to have you back on.
Oh, I'd love to be back on. I think you guys are your focus on the family is so helpful for everybody. We all have issues, no matter what age we are, about how to integrate and make our families and our family members successful. So I'd love to come back. And what's next for me is I'm continuing to train horses and work with horses. I'm working on a new book on the human brain, and it keeps going.
Well, when you have the new book coming out, please let us know. We would love to have you back. If you get out to Southern California, please let us know. Would love to meet with you in person and talk a little deeper. And again, for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar to tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for more inspiring and educational ways to improve your family's health, happiness, and success. And one way to never miss a show is to subscribe to Answers for the Family free through your iTunes account.
and to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
For everybody out there, be good human beings, and we look forward to you listening to us again next week. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.